And welcome to another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
What do you have for us, Bill?
Well, our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. So if you're looking for a tractor, a mower, implements, parts, service, they do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake. They're also the new Ego Electric lawn care distributor. So they have zero-turn mowers, riding mowers, handheld, commercial handheld. They've got it all up there. Go up and see them.
What's the difference between regular handheld and commercial handheld?
No, commercial's a little heavier duty.
Because if you're hiring people who don't take care of the tools?
Yeah, it comes with termination papers. So, they've got it all in stock. Go up and see them. Or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. Or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
I haven't helped you with the commercial lately, so
I've been struggling.
I thought you were due for some.
Yeah, thanks, but no thanks.
That you were due for some harassment.
Yeah.
I could feel it. Oh, my goodness. Well, we have been doing a lot of kind of different stuff of late. And if you have not heard the show before, you can find everything back almost 14 years, actually, archives that are free to listen to, uninterrupted, a.k.a. no commercials. We didn't edit out Bill, though. We let his commercials stay in there.
Yeah.
But we took out all the free enterprise moments, and they're free to listen to at wethepeopleradio.us. You can, it's not just the archives, you know, the sound archives, actually. We've got any of the things that our guests have talked about, papers they've written, references, video, any of those links, that's all on there, and you're free to do whatever you like with it, and we hope you'll use it to educate people. That's why we show up here on Sundays. that's our thought anyway.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, we educate you on things you didn't want to know, you know, rock through the window, crazy stuff like that.
Well, and it's like Glenn Beck says, it's the fusion of education and enlightenment.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Wow. That doesn't sound fun, actually.
That's a mouthful.
I'm going to need to have more fun. There's going to have to be something more fun. The music is fun. We usually have fun music. And we've been doing some shows on the transgender deal. There is currently an initiative running in the state of California on that to help parents, you know, get a little protection from the school districts who want to be the parents. And if you have not seen that or heard about that, go to the archives at wethepeopleradio.us, click on the transgender tab, and you can actually print those signed initiatives yourself. It is March 3rd today, 2024, and that'll roll until that initiative has to be in by middle of April. So you have like 6 weeks. Hmm. So if that's an issue of interest to you, please get involved in that. And we'll be speaking with the district attorney here at the end of the month, and there is an initiative being run by the district attorneys in the state of California regarding Prop 47, the one that turned... The short version is it turned a whole bunch of our felonies into misdemeanors, which I know this is crazy, but it spiked crime. Huh. Imagine that. Stop punishing people, they commit more crimes. Crazy.
Yeah. Well, they weren't that bad. Just, you know, battery and, you know.
Yeah, just, you know, like huge theft and whatnot. Yeah. So we'll be chatting with her about that, and I'll post that as quickly as I can. There are initiatives to sign. They've got to have 500,000 signatures out there. And that is one where you're going to need to get the actual paperwork from someone who has it. I'll find that out and post it as quickly as I can, because you can't print them yourself. They're on these huge sheets that are trifold. So anyway, the transgender one, you can print yourself out of your own little printer. So there you go.
There you are.
It's my commercial moment.
There you have it.
Our guest. We have two different guests today. So first hour, we are talking to Dr. I forgot to put doctor in front of his name. Gosh, he spent all that time in medical school, and I undoctored him. Dr. Josh. And Dr. Josh, can you remind me, how do I say your last name? Is it Umber? Uh-oh. He's in the cone of silence.
Yeah, no worries.
Uncone him. Okay, how do I say it again?
It's Umber, like lumber.
Umber, like lumber, darn it. We haven't talked to you in, like, I think we spoke with you a year, like in 2020. It was a long time ago.
It's been a while.
It didn't seem that long. And then I had to look back for the archives. And I thought, oh, darn it, now I've already forgotten. And your name is deceptively simple, U-M-B-E-H-R. But it has some extra, it has those letters that sort of make you feel like you're blowing
a
it.
German H. Yes, exactly.
<That's right.
laughs> It has the, you're going to screw this up written all over it. And I was like, oh, man. So you are, the article, Lowering Healthcare Costs Through Site-Neutral Policies. So on the surface, like regular people kind of lose the last part, but lowering healthcare costs, that's, you know, not to bury the lead. I think everybody would like to do that.
Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen healthcare costs go down.
Yeah, really bad. And you're in Wichita, Kansas?
Yep.
Yeah. So, and so you have, you're always writing things about this. You're always doing studies, but we haven't talked to you in a few years. So tell us about your article and maybe what you've been up to. And you're kind of a policy guy in addition to
people
healthier.
You know, we've made the last 14 years our mission to help lower healthcare costs and help doctors and patients and look for innovative solutions. And yeah, the main movement is known as direct care, direct primary care. And part of that is seeing how the government can do things better, and so hence the site-neutral op-ed. But again, part of a larger mission to see how we can decrease insurance costs by providing health care in a more cost-effective way. We're really using insurance as a hammer when it should be a wrench. And so we can beat on it for a while, but we don't get good outcomes. So thinking about it different solves the problem in new and better ways.
Yeah, you know, we're seeing this in a, like, the little part of your bio that I thought was really interesting. So you're a family physician, and then you opened Atlas MD that you had kind of been, it says in your bio, a practice I'd been dreaming about for nearly a decade. And Atlas MD represents the ideal medical practice where you were able to shrug off the burdens and restrictions of government and insurance regulation so you can focus on patients. And I think anybody who is kind of trapped in the regular, the standard system, how about that? Physicians are so under the gun, they don't have the time to spend with their patients. They have to just keep in and out, to meet all the criteria, and then there's a ton of paperwork.
Yes, you know, patients always say, I hate going to the doctor's office, and surprise, surprise, so do doctors. it's not good for anybody. And it's, again, because we keep doing the same thing and expecting a different result, and the paperwork doesn't add any value to the patients. It's not helping make things faster, easier, better. It's not confirming a diagnosis. And so you really just have to, like, kind of first principle style, step back and ask, why are we doing so much of that? We don't have car insurance for gasoline or oil changes or windshield washers.
God, don't give them any ideas.
Exactly, yeah. So why are we using health insurance for family medicine and a lot of outpatient care and that's the big caveat, if we could make that as affordable as gasoline? The thankful reality is we really can. We dispense medicines directly out of our office. That's one innovative option for docs and patients. And so when you go direct to the manufacturers, they're 95% less when you cut out the big box retailers and their shareholders. So, you know, I can get 1,000 blood pressure pills for $8. You know, that's 3 years worth of medicine now, basically. So you don't need insurance for that. That's not to say insurance was bad. It's just it's not necessary anymore. And your cholesterol test is $3, and your thyroid test is $2. And so if we just go about it in a smarter way, then the best part about having affordable health insurance is not needing affordable health insurance to cover these types of things. Then patients get more care more often for less money, faster, easier, and their insurance premiums go down. So, it should sound too good to be true, but it's been, like I said, part of our mission for a long time, and now there's thousands of doctors and millions of patients participating with that grassroots movement.
Wow. And so I remember you telling us this, that your costs were so low, but I forget how you made that happen.
you know, I'd like to say it was more complicated than it was. Just like any restaurant has a wholesaler, the pharmacies have wholesalers. And so the manufacturers will either sell them direct or sell them to a middleman to make that easy. But then, so everyone likes to talk about the price of healthcare, and I think that gets lost. That's different than the cost. Cost is just actually, you know, the bottom line. Price is all the markup and bloat and paperwork and red tape that gets added on top. So when you say, you know, 45 states allow physicians to do this, we have a license to prescribe and dispense, so that when you do that, we'll cut out all the middlemen. There's no need to run it through insurance and add paperwork and add staff and all these things. So you buy a bottle of 1,000, physicians can count. So we just count out 30 or 60 or 90, and that's it. There's nothing more complicated. Which is why it's sort of embarrassingly easy that doctors either aren't doing it now or haven't been doing it for forever. We let that value to our patients go because we got so busy filing paperwork with insurance. So we kind of lost our way. I blame doctors more than I blame insurance companies. They pay for care. We provide the care. So we're front and center. We can look for those innovative solutions. And if it was really complex, then I could understand docs dragging their feet on that. But for 30% of everything your insurance pays for is prescriptions, there's definitely a large return on investment for doctors to learn how to do that so that they can turn around and help their patients get the meds they need at a fraction of the price.
Do you get any feedback from the pharmacies on these plans? I mean, you're actually basically cutting them out of the formula in a lot of cases. Are they giving you any feedback on that?
Well, they don't love it, but pharmacists don't love their job as it is anyways, right? Most corporate big box pharmacies are, you know, a professional sweatshop. It's very frustrating, and they're not happy there either with PBMs and gag orders, and they see these high prices that, you know, aren't consistent with the actual cost of meds, and they, you know, run into all these insurance-based issues, which is, you know, it's kind of like paying the hammer to slam your thumb, right? We did this to ourselves. In a future version of this, you'd have so many patients needing the meds that you'd hire your own pharmacist for a group of docs to make that workflow efficient. Or the pharmacist could probably outcompete us. They get prices in bigger bulk, so even a better discount. And I think it's like any business. If you put the patients first and then work backwards, good things happen. But you could have a pharmacy that's a mom and pop like any restaurant and say it's a $5 membership or it's cost plus a dollar or these sort of things. It makes less sense to involve insurance more and more often, since that's the thing kind of choking the life out of affordable care. So pharmacists can innovate in that space too and find a way either to compete with us or work with us, but as long as we're getting meds 95% less for patients, it's going to be a win-win.
Yeah, I you know, when I go to the pharmacy, probably without exception, there's somebody in line or somebody at the counter fighting over price and what their insurance will authorize and won't authorize and what they'll pay for and the cost. And it would seem to me that your plan would make sense for them if they could cut out, I mean, just in labor alone, the amount of time these people spend on the computer trying to get insurance authorization, you'd think that they would save a ton of money there.
Yeah, and you know, no one went to med school or pharmacy school to do paperwork.
Exactly.
And so, you know, it's not what they love doing either. They'd rather be with the patient, adding value, explaining meds, or, you know, answering questions. And instead, we've got them doing paperwork that slows the whole thing down. To slow the whole thing down.
Mm-hmm.
And so imagine what everything else in the store would cost, right? And that's sort of the funny thing, especially with pharmacies and grocery stores or convenience stores, is the entire rest of the business model is built on transparent prices and competing and value. And then when it comes to the pharmacy aisle, that all completely changes.
It does.
We couldn't possibly tell you what a medicine costs or whatnot, and we can only deal through your insurance, and there's gag orders about talking on discounts. So they know how to do it. It's right there. It's every other product in their store.
Well, it's a huge business, too. I mean, you go into these pharmacies and look at the shelves where they're storing medicines for people to come in and pick up. I mean, there's
Whoever's making those little bags the one really, really raking it in.
I'd just like to have the take on the staples they use to put all those bags together. I mean, there's literally hundreds and hundreds of prescriptions sitting there waiting for customers.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, in some cases, the bottle and the label does cost more than the medicine. Walmart has a $4 a month list. Direct Care has a $4 a year list. We're 12 times more competitive than Walmart. Because Walmart, one, the $4 list was incredible when they started that, but they haven't innovated since the mid 2000s on that, and they want that profit margin because everything else is struggling, and so no one's come out and really innovated hard. Direct Care is generally 80% cheaper than Amazon, 70% cheaper than GoodRx, and I would say the best of the best is Mark Cuban. He does a similar startup, Cost Plus Pharmacy, but we're still 45% cheaper than they are.
Wow.
So, because we don't need to make a profit.
Bottom line is, at this point, for most of us, if we flew to Wichita to get our medication and flew home, it'd be cheaper. We would still save money.
Find a direct care doc near you. Some meds, because people will often say, well, yeah, it's fine for blood pressure meds, but you can't do that for chemotherapy meds. And we can. I mean, it does definitely depend on the medicine, but at a patient with a brain tumor, we saved him $24,000 on every treatment by getting it wholesale.
Holy crap.
Just the insane markup. Or the difference at Walgreens between the seizure medicine, that's $108 per month, is $1.32 with Direct Care. And I think that's
I don't even know if I could do the math on that.
Yeah, that's just crazy.
More than 99%.
Yeah, I was like, wait, do we have that many decimal places? We have to take a really quick break. When we come back, though, I know that part of your article is about Medicare, and that is a huge, huge segment of our population these days, our folks on Medicare, and it's got some issues. So you have some ideas on Medicare, and I'd like to... Let's delve into that a wee bit.
Sure.
We'll come back to the drugs. We'll just weave the drugs in and out. 99% off. What the heck? All right. Our guest is Dr. Josh Lumber. Kidding. Umber.
Nice.
I just changed it. Oh, my God. Yeah. Atlas MD. I think this is amazing. It is March 3rd, 2024. Hit the page at wethepeopleradio.us and learn all about it. It's a really good idea. We'll be right back.
My family doctor for a pain inside my head. I told him the tunes you left me, I was feeling like just about dead. Well, doctor, what can you give me? And could I take one or two? Can you tell me just what it's gonna do? Will it save me from what I'm going through? Will it ease the pain?
There we go. Back on track here with the music. Spam was just a throwback from last week. Yeah. Dr. Umber, if you come on more frequently with us, we'll play the Weird Al songs for you.
That's the deal.
We were talking about a gal who was a vegan for 20 years and realized that it was basically killing her. So she started eating meat, and, well, you know, we had to play the spam song.
She got her color back.
Yeah, she realized that she was, like, gray, like the, you know, like a cloudy day, and she... What'd she do? She ate tuna, and her skin turned pink. I was like, oh, my God. So, anyway, we won't ask you to bring the hate on yourself by discussing the quality of vegan lifestyle, because apparently that it got her, bomb threats, and they tried to burn down her house.
Yeah, they came after her.
Pretty unpleasant.
Yeah.
You know, the people with all that...
the energy for it.
Yeah, I know. With, all that really? All that tolerance apparently boiled over. How about... So, on this thing with Medicare, back to reality. On this thing with Medicare, there are obviously the baby boomers are all in the Medicare system. I think now, I'm not an expert on generational, you know, time frames, but basically the baby boomers are all on Medicare now. And that's a huge strain on the system. And as a doctor, like you point out in your thing here, when, you know, a regular guy like you with a family practice, you get reimbursed. I couldn't even guess how small it is. I'm sure you know. But if they go to a hospital, you know, a big practice, and the doctors are part of a hospital group, reimbursement's totally different. What a rip.
No, yeah, it's a shame. And part of the problem, I think, that why patients get so frustrated with the system is it doesn't feel fair, because it's not. It's designed to be confusing and frustrating, and then kind of the law of good intentions plays into effect here, where the idea made sense on its face to the writers of the Medicare bill originally, who never practiced medicine, so they, I think, had a limited view of how it worked. But if you accept the idea that it's more expensive to provide some care in the hospital, then it sort of makes sense to say, okay, fine, we'll reimburse the hospitals more for the types of care they provide because it costs more. That incentivizes Medicare patients to be able to get access to hospital stuff when they need it. And then that was misused and abused by hospitals buying up doctors' offices and then calling them satellite locations of their hospital so that they could bill more for everything. So it was a poorly written law, abused for sure, and needs to be corrected, but probably won't be. That's why, on a Friday, you might go to your doctor's office and get a simple, straightforward bill, and then a week or two later, go back and get this unrecognizable bill that includes a hospital component, several hundred dollars more expecting, and all that, because the hospitals are saying, now your blood pressure is being managed in a hospital location, even though nothing's changed.
Yeah, there was... we went to a... an awards, it wasn't an awards ceremony, it was a healthcare dinner.
Oh, it was a Northern Valley Medical, it was all the physicians.
All the physicians. And one of the conversations we had with one of the doctors, one of his cohorts worked out of a rural hospital, and for the same procedure that this other doctor got $320 reimbursement for, he got eight, and he said that he said it doesn't even make sense to perform those when you don't get paid for them.
Right, depending on what it was, somebody's being underpaid and someone's being overpaid, and then you times that by the thousands of procedures that you can bill Medicare for,
right,
and you've got quite a real problem. So we need to standardize this, and if anything, 20% of our entire GDP is healthcare, and we don't have transparent pricing there. That just blows my mind, because I would never buy anything from Apple or Amazon if I had no idea what the price is. And during the previous administration, there was a lot of forward momentum on price transparency, and then hospitals fought that pretty hard and played games, and now they're being kind of forced to reveal some of their prices, but they're not they're not trying to, and they're not putting patients first. Then, and then, well, we'd rather have these unpredictable prices and then give you this discount back, but you don't know if it's a fair discount because it's just another layer of confusion. Versus, again, cost versus price. What does it actually cost? Well, it cost me 40 cents to do an EKG on you, right? So do I need $100 for that? No, not really. The coffee in the waiting room costs 80 cents a cup, but I can't bill your insurance for that either. So we need to have more transparency in how hospitals are run and what Medicare bills, bring that back to something closer to reality.
Is there some of this that kind of falls back to the patient? I mean, when you go to a doctor and he checks you all out and then he hands you a lab slip and says, hey, go to your lab and have him draw blood, and he has all the tests are going to run on this lab slip. Nobody looks at that and goes, well, how much do each one of these tests cost? I mean, what are they? What are we looking for? I don't know that patients in a lot of cases ask enough questions, because when you go and get that testing done, your insurance company gets a bill, you pay a fairly small copay, but you know, it could be hundreds or thousands of dollars that somebody's paying for all that testing.
Right. Yeah, and I think the consumer-driven healthcare was a buzz phrase, you know, years ago, and sounds great and seems to make sense on its face, until you kind of think about, A, the system isn't designed to be easy for consumers, right? The lab isn't going to tell you the price, and the price is marked up drastically, and it may or may not depend on the coding that the doctor did or what they documented or what insurance you have or what year it is or what your plan setup is. And so no one can just tell you, like they can in the grocery store, what it should be,
right?
Except direct care.
Right, right.
You know, and that's the beauty of our passion, is I can tell you exactly what our price is, and for the most common lab tests, it's 95% less. You know, a CBC to check your blood counts, your iron levels, $2, right? So again, you shouldn't even need insurance for that, but that should just be listed.
Right.
And every other industry actually is trying to make it easier to be a consumer, right? If I go to Best Buy and try to buy a TV, they're going to tell me the price.
Right.
And the last time I did, they even went so far as to find coupons online from other stores to make sure I didn't leave, and then honored those coupons. So I got to be a lazy consumer. And in healthcare, we try to be like, well, you know, if you do all your own legwork, then maybe you get a discount, but it's still rigged against you.
Well, the other one that's become really, I mean, so different since it used to be, I mean, you know, 30, 40 years ago, you went to buy a car, and it was kind of like, you know, you got on your suit of armor, and you put two padlocks on your wallet, you know, and then you went and you looked at the vehicle. And now it's like, the price is the price is the price. You're going to buy it or not buy it. I mean, even car sales has become more consumer-friendly from a price standpoint.
Right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, CarMax made their entire business model off, we'll be honest to you. That's how far the industry had shrunken or sank. And no one else would do that. No one else would be able to get away with that. It's expected to be transparent and fair and easy.
Well, we haven't since we haven't spoken with you since, you know, the great meltdown. I've noticed, at least, not necessarily in our county, but in the county to the north of us, that's far more rural. There were a lot of healthcare workers that were fired from the local hospital because they wouldn't get the shot. That was really the catalyst. I mean, the whole crazy mask thing and all that stuff was another kind of another layer of annoyance. But the vaccine was a huge problem for people, and they said, nope, it's not worth it to me to put myself at risk. I'm out. And those people have all coalesced. It's taken them a while, but they have created a system called The Well. And so they have, you know, a doctor, a physical therapist. They have all the little pieces, and they have a member. It's a membership. I think it's like $100 a year or something. It's not a lot. And they don't you know, they'll give you a super bill. You can go bill your insurance if you want to, but their prices are not, they haven't taken your model. But I'm gonna share your information. I should have thought of this before. Just heard them speak. But people are able to get care, reasonable, you know, in a reasonable way.
Amazing thing. You know, if you experiment a little bit and say, well, if we just don't put everything through insurance, are there other options? And of course there are, right? You know, some of these have been around all the time. Mm-hmm. Plastic surgery is almost exclusively cash-based because it's cosmetic and not covered. And a lot of dentistry is that way. And so, you know, mental health, the cash-based therapist, and, you know, the 15-minute couch hour. Seems so foreign for doctors to apply it to themselves because we're not taught business. In fact, if anything, we're taught that business is bad. It's unbecoming and unprofessional of a physician to muddy their hands. But then you get this result. You get doctors aren't involved and admin are. Well, if it's unprofessional for us, it should be unprofessional for them. The point of the matter is, yes, we're all running a business. We all need to pay our bills, but we also need to do it in a way that's fair and transparent and equitable to our customer. And you know, you could do a just fee for service model. That's your standard movie theater, or somewhat Amazon pay for a video, rent a video. Then you've got your Netflix. You've got your Costco. Costco is a brilliant model, and they make 75% of their revenue profits off of just the membership. And if you give us the membership, we can afford to give everything else out almost at cost. I believe it's cost plus 14% typically. And they're constantly trying to say, how do we bring more value over to our customers, right? You know, the hot dog that hasn't changed prices in 30 years, the rotisserie chicken that they're most definitely losing money on, but because they're putting their customer first and their value and commitment is you know, shown right there. I think doctors should be somewhat embarrassed that we can't meet the customer, beat or exceed the customer service setting that is set by other companies. But it's just because we're stuck in the, everyone else bills insurance for things, so I will, until I see something different that's working and thriving. But that's why the direct care movement's growing so quickly, I think, is, once patients do see there's a better way, and doctors see that they can be happier and not suicidal, it's absorbed, it's adopted quicker and quicker all the time.
Well, and they don't have to worry that, because, like, my doctor, they give me a super bill, I can send it to the insurance company, but he is not part of any insurance network because he wants to practice medicine. I mean, he's really upfront about it. He said, I can't actually treat patients the way I want to because they're all over me. And, like, during the pandemic, they were all over him. We're going to take your medical license, and California was really ugly.
And I can understand how patients might kind of reject that a little bit, like you're putting the work back on me. But at the same time,
no, it's easy. I mean, it's just not that big a deal.
It's part of that, but it also makes the insurance responsible to their customer. And then they can, you know, jerk the physician around on the administrative side, and you've got to call, and you've got to do a peer-to-peer, and you've got to resubmit the whole chart and all these sort of things, and then just leverage bureaucracy against them. But it's much harder to do that to the customer writing you a check every month and have, you know, such poor service. So in some ways, it re-centers the relationship in the way that it should be. You know, I'm upset with Apple, I call Apple. I don't call other center. Yeah, it doesn't care.
How did it come about that insurance companies, you go to a doctor and he prescribes a certain medication, you submit it to your insurance, and your insurance says, oh, no, we're not going to pay for that. Figure out something else. I don't know. To me, that seems like they're practicing medicine. But just the fact that they don't want to pay for something, it doesn't seem like that's okay to me. And you hear about that all the time. I mean, it's happened to me. I submit a prescription. Oh, it hasn't been authorized by your insurance. well, why do I go to a doctor if the insurance company is going to be the ultimate decision maker on my health?
hold that thought. I just realized we're this is going very fast. We're time traveling with you today. It must be the Kansas effect. That's what we're we're going to blame it on Kansas. We have to take a quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Nice job, Bill.
Hey, thanks.
Doctor, my eyes have seen the years and the slow parade of fears without crying. Now I want to understand. I have done all that I could to see the evil and the good without hiding. You must help me if you can. Doctor, my eyes, tell me what is wrong. Was I unwise to leave them open for so long?
Brother bought a coconut, he bought it for the diamond. Sister had another one, she paid it for the lime. She put the lime in the coconut, she drank and pulled up. She put the lime in the coconut, she called the doctor, woke him up and said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor, to relieve this bellyache. I said, Doctor, ain't there nothing I can take? I said, Doctor.
I was crying to be played. You can't go wrong with the lime and the coconut song.
Especially when talking to a doctor.
I know, that's why it just seemed so much fun. So, Bill, back to Bill's drug story. Sorry, I was just
had my own question. The insurance companies, how do they get away with that? I mean, a doctor prescribes a drug, they don't want to pay for it, and so they basically require the doctor to change his diagnosis or prescription.
Yeah, you have to practice creative medicine now to get your patients whatever they're supposed to take.
Well, I think it's a mixed bag, and you'll rarely hear me defend insurance companies, but I think we rail on them, and that doesn't change anything. As a doctor, I think we should put the responsibility back on the doctor, and there's plenty of times where they're playing games, the insurance. There's plenty of times where they're looking out for the patient. They are not practicing medicine. That is correct. They are saying, this is what we will or will not pay for, and then the rest is sort of implied so that we can keep your premiums at the rate that they are, right? And then everyone is upset every year when the rates go up, inevitably. And so it's one of those where, yeah, if you don't mind what your premiums are, we can pay for everything, but then your premiums are going to double every couple of years. Mm-hmm. So it's this weird self-balancing. For the same medication or for the same issue, I can prescribe a medicine that's 8 cents a pill or $34 a pill. So which would you rather have your insurance pay for if it affects your insurance premiums?
Well, right? as long as both of them do the same thing or are going to give you the same outcome, I would hope that the doctor would prescribe a drug that would be economical for the patient and do what it's supposed to do.
Agreed. Yeah, I think we should start with sort of the, quote, best medication for the patient, but the best, most cost-effective medication for the patient.
Do you know that as a physician, when you go to prescribe something, do you have like a secret book somewhere?
Well, see, I do, because in direct care, we buy the meds, so I know what the prices are. Mm. It's not just even the wholesale price. I know which one is much cheaper versus much more expensive. Of course, generics cheaper than name brand and these sort of things. But that is part of the problem. The average doctor is so busy with the things you said earlier, seeing 30 or 40 people a day, and then spending as much time charting as they are in front of the patient. They're charting after hours, nights, weekends, burning out, missing their family, being suicidal. So the idea to throw on yet another thing of, and know how much every drug is at every pharmacy, becomes almost unknowable. But that's also why you should have an in-house, because then you do know that, and it saves everybody time and gets more care more often at a better price. So the insurance is saying the doctor is in front of the patient, and how do you judge the doctor? That if the patient gets a medicine that they want, or name brand, or better, right? We can all eat a chicken sandwich, but depending on, you know, we're going to think that's a better chicken sandwich if it comes from Chick-fil-A versus McDonald's or something. We like our Starbucks coffee more than gas station coffee, and we're okay paying 10 times as much for it. The difference is we expect coffee at the gas station to be a dollar, coffee at Starbucks to be $8. We don't realize that there might be, you know, $1,000 difference per month between a name brand and a generic, or one medicine and another. But if you tell a patient, I'm going to prescribe you a really good, strong medicine, they're happy. And they want name brand because they want name brand Starbucks. They don't want to think they're getting gas station coffee. Right. And so the incentive is, how do I make the patient in front of me happy so that they don't go online, bash me online, and you know, bother my staff and do all these things? So in a weird way, they are kind of hurting themselves of telling the patient to get the most expensive med and then waiting for insurance to not pay or not pay for that. But then we took an oath to do no harm, and I think that means do no financial harm, and we have to be able to look at that in the bigger picture of, if I prescribe a $34 a day medicine versus an 8 cents a day medicine, I am going to make you lose your insurance at some point.
Sure.
Or someone is going to lose their insurance.
Sure, because the cost goes crazy.
Yeah. Right, that's just such a huge difference. It's unabsorbable at some point. And the insurance company would totally absorb it if you're willing to pay, you know, $60 more a month for your insurance. But that's, you know, a $720 per year increase. Well, but you get that, you know, in 1 to 12 months from now. You want the medicine now, and when you're sick, I want a strong medicine or a good medicine. And there's a wonderful economic book on this called Predictably Irrational. You know, you're not supposed to buy your wife the on-sale diamond. I did. But you're not supposed to, and because somehow it means less. And so people, you know, price anchor, and, oh, the more expensive medicine must be better. And then no one's giving them information. They're just being told no by someone. A pharmacist, who's a guy in the middle, you know, or a woman, and the insurance, who they can't really talk to, and the doctor's too busy. So, again, We can blame all these vague entities, or we can ask the doctor to take ownership of that and bring the $34 medicine. And the funny thing about that whole conversation, they're the same medicine.
Yeah. Right.
So in this case, it's the difference between the generic medicine wholesale and the generic medicine at the pharmacy. So sometimes it's the exact same medicine that's $34 more than it should be, because the doctor's not maybe diving as deep into the solution as we can. So we eliminate the entire process of the pharmacy and insurance, and at the end of the day, we decrease your insurance premiums by 30%. If we could do that, we would go back to early 2000s, late 90s insurance premiums.
God, wouldn't that
be nice?
And
that would be, you know, $500 extra in the back of every household in their pocket. That would be,
if you could figure out how to do that and lower gas prices, you could run for president right now.
Well, I'm halfway there. Yeah.
I just want you to know, like, for the record, we drank gas station coffee less than 12 hours ago.
I grew up on hospital coffee, which is worse than
I love gas station coffee. I never drink Starbucks. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't give them all that money. That's crazy.
And I love generic meds.
See? And I do too. Yeah. I used to get all my stuff from Canada back when you could do that. You send your prescription to Canada and you get, you know, thyroid meds for, I don't know, 6 months for $10 or some crazy thing. And it's like, I knew 30 years ago, if you could do that, wait a second, something wrong with this. Talk about this site-neutral part so that we don't, well, we're totally running out of time, but so we don't run out of time without hitting that, because that's kind of what, that's one of your solutions you're proposing, is this idea of a site-neutral policy and the study that was done last year.
Medicare ends up just being such a huge spender, and so then they end up being the probably biggest source of waste as well. And they set the rules that a lot of the rest of the industry follows. So when they do something like this pricing discrepancy, well, then everyone else wants to do it too, right? So then everyone follows the leader, even if that's bad for patients. And so the Medicare rules that allow hospitals to get reimbursed more for treating blood pressure in the hospital that then get abused, so they buy up doctor's offices, not because they want to run them better, but because they want to bill the patient as if the patient was in a hospital all the time. Well, that's bad for, you know, the patient. That's, the doctor doesn't see extra money from that. The insurance premiums go up, employer premiums go up. Yeah, that has to be drawn from somewhere, so that generally draws from, you know, payroll, and it's just hurting everyone and not adding any value. So we've tripled the cost of care because of this, you know, well-intentioned law, but poorly executed law. So we need to bring that back so that we can put a stop to the abuse of these hospital-owned clinics pretending and masquerading as if they're providing more complex, more expensive care when they're really just kind of padding the bottom line.
Is there anything being done with that? Is that a process that's happening now, or is it just like it would be great if?
Yeah, just great if. Other than, you know, random Wichita doctors writing op-eds, you know, the system isn't, they're very good at creating new laws. They're very bad at removing bad laws.
Yeah.
And the next one will be just abused. I mean, you know, at this point, we've gone through 3 decades of this that I can remember, whether it was pay for performance or this alphabet soup of initiatives, macro or MIPS, or these just reporting requirements where they get, you know, misused and abused, and we're supposed to save the system money, but then just no one's seen the system ever get cheaper. So clearly they're not working.
It's and then, but there are all these spinoffs coming from this. Are you seeing that in your area? All these different types of arrangements. You know, the concierge type of an arrangement. The like the one I was talking about earlier that has all the different practitioners who've kind of band together so that they can all practice, but none of them can afford to be standalone because they'd have to have their own facility and all that. So, you know, they kind of, it's like the old days of the co-op.
You know, I think we are. You know, we started this in 2010, but I always joke the family docs are a little farther ahead than the specialists when it comes to frustration, because, you know, the specialists always get paid more money for what they're doing, so they don't have to see as many patients, and then they're the end of the line, so they, you know, the paperwork can only be so much for them. And now all of the same things we were dealing with in 2010, they're dealing with now and have been for years. And so they're getting frustrated and burnt out and saying, how can we practice medicine without insurance? And that's the beautiful thing, is specialists can do this like anyone else, whether it's fee-for-service or membership. We're all providing care to patients who need it, but we're doing it through this very broken, bloated system. So carve it all back, have transparent prices, wholesale meds, wholesale labs, free procedures, no co-pays, and, you know, the patients respond really well to stuff like that. And now, as insurance premiums are at, you know, literally an all-time high, and for 2024, this was the single largest one-year price increase since 2012, I think everyone's saying, I'm paying more than I ever did. I have less money than I normally have because of inflation, and I'm getting the least amount of care for all of this. They're looking, so like, all right, you know, I just want to see my doctor. I just want to be able to get my blood pressure and cholesterol meds and not, you know, make it such an ordeal. And so they are. They're adopting, and the grassroots movement is growing. And now, generally, we launch 20 to 30 new doctors and direct care new clinics each month around the country. It's picking up more momentum all the time.
Nice. Do you guys have what kind of marketing campaign, I guess, do you have out for this?
Well, in some ways, this is it. You know, we just provide a lot of good care to good people and talk about it.
Nice.
And tell patients if they like it, tell their boss, tell their neighbors, and it's better to do that and build the momentum than try to oversell it. And there's always national conferences that doctors can attend. We provide all of our consulting to doctors free of charge.
Well, we're gonna start writing your phone number on the bathroom wall, I think. Now that we have it, thank God.
Yeah.
I'll make sure and put the phonetic spelling of your name now so it comes out right.
There you go, yes.
Dr. Josh Umber, thank you so much. We hope you're enjoying Wichita, Kansas these days, and we hope to have you on sooner than 3 long years. Keep writing the op-eds.
Yep, thanks for coming
on.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, guys.
We'll be right back. We're going to talk about ESG next hour. Another episode of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff. And our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery. They're our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. You can get pretty much anything tractor-wise, mower-wise, handheld. They've got it all up there. Go up and see them. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in the city of Shasta Lake, right between Pine Grove and Oasis Boulevard off-ramps. And or you can give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226. And like I say, you can go up there and get parts, service, sales. They do it all up there. And or you can get them on the web. Their address is papemachinery.com.
Ta-da! Well, I guess I'll reiterate, actually. How about that? WeThePeopleRadio.us is the website. Today is March the 3rd, 2024, and we hope that you will take these programs that we've been doing for 13 and a half years and share them with friends, family, whomever. We do this to provide an audio library for people. It doesn't cost money to listen. The website is easy to figure out. We have topics. I've done a lot of topics on a lot of things on marijuana, China, environmental stuff, government, national security, veterans. Did a really lengthy series on South Africa, Islam, just all sorts of things. And if you have topics that you would like us to cover, we're always happy to go find some experts for you so you can hear from people that you wouldn't normally have access to in the you see people interviewed for a minute or a minute and a half. You don't learn anything. So we try to have longer conversations with folks. Today's second hour here is about ESG. Our guest, Paul Tice, has written a book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. I think we all kind of think this, but we can't prove it. Because that's not our field of expertise. This is, however, his field of expertise. He's worked on Wall Street for the past 3 decades, and he teaches. He's got an MBA in finance. It's just all sorts of things going on with him. I don't know how much of it he wants to share with everybody, but he's got the cred, and I posted it online for you if you'd like to see. But I want him to tell us about this race to zero, because it's becoming really clear that ESG is not helpful.
No, it's not helpful. And I think a lot of people have heard the term ESG. They don't really understand what
true.
It is. And so they just kind of sit back, and a lot of this just happens around them, and we're not really doing a lot to stop it. But thankfully, Mr. Tice will inform us and let us know exactly what is ESG and why he wrote this book.
All right, you got
race to zero.
Got the floor there. Races to zero.
Okay. Hi, Aaron. Hi, Bill. It's good to be with you guys.
Sure.
Let me give you the 2 second on my background just to give you a feel for where I'm coming from. So I worked on Wall Street for 40 years. I retired a couple of years ago. And roughly the first half of my career was on the sell side. The second half of my career was on the buy side. And the major firms I worked at over the years were J.P. Morgan, Lehman Brothers, and then BlackRock. And for the past 30-plus years, I have specialized in the energy sector, both as a sell-side analyst and as an investor. And that's given me kind of a front seat to this whole ESG movement, which is targeted all on climate change and then the energy sector in turn. And then, as you mentioned, I've been teaching for the last 10 years down at NYU Stern, which is my alma mater. So I wrote the book mainly because, to your point, no one is really talking about this, what's going on in the financial markets. People are kind of aware. There has been, you know, increased pushback the last couple of years, but no one has ever actually given an insider's view, having worked on Wall Street. And there's a reason for that. You're not allowed to have a divergence opinion about this. You're not allowed to criticize. It's a very totalitarian approach in terms of ESG, and, you know, it's a problem when you disagree with the CEO who's telling you this is what we're going to do. So I thought it was important to kind of articulate why ESG is such a bad thing, and I do think there is a silent majority on Wall Street that will agree with this once they read the book. And I also, I think, tactically, I agree with some of the approach of certain people, politicians and others, in terms of how do you attack ESG. You know, I think we need to keep the focus on climate change and the defunding of oil and gas, which is the main objective of ESG, as opposed to being distracted by some of the more cultural issues and woke issues that have been attached to the movement. Not to minimize those, they're obviously serious, but I think climate change really is the priority around ESG, and the other side will tell you that to your face.
Yeah, it's all about climate change, and the funding tactics that the banks and the financial institutions are using are going to reshape things if we don't get a handle on this. And this has been happening in Europe for quite some time. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think Europe is you know, obviously the leading edge of a lot of these UN-led verticals, if you will. So climate change, sustainable development, and also ESG investing. All of these movements are intertwined. They're really three legs of the same stool, and they're being led by the United Nations. And if you look at who are the strongest champions of that, it's the European member countries of the UN. Mm-hmm. And that's also true when it comes to financial regulations that are going to impose this ESG approach on all financial institutions. So, you know, Europe is you know, showing us, you know, what's in store for the U.S. unless we can reverse this.
Right.
But it's all intertwined, and you can kind of view it. I think it's important to, you know, again, you know, the first step towards solving a problem is acknowledging you have a problem mm-hmm. and the scope of it. Yeah. And, you know, the other side has a 40-year head start on us in terms of pushing this agenda. And in the book, I trace it all the way back to the 80s. And you can even go further back, because you can view ESG as kind of just the latest anti-capitalist movement that goes back 200 years. You know, the idea of reimagining capitalism, you know, you're basically replacing it with something else. You're not, you know, modifying it, no matter what you call it. So I think we need to have that in mind that, you know, they've got a 40-year head start on us, and they're committed to it. There's a lot of vested capital here. People have made careers on this, so they're not going to give up, you know, willingly. So I think that needs to color our tactics going forward.
Now, you mentioned in your book, too, that even though it has been really taking hold in Europe, the United States is kind of fighting back a little bit on this. In fact, you mentioned BlackRock. I heard not too long ago that they were kind of trying to get out of the whole ESG thing because of the devastation that it's leaving in its wake. It's not investor oriented, so to speak.
Yeah, I would throw headlines like that BlackRock is backing away from ESG is under the category of fake news, honestly.
Oh, really?
I think what we're seeing is kind of a tactical retreat by some of the leading advocates in terms of Wall Street firms. So obviously, Larry Fink has been, you know, the spokesman has been most vocal about sustainability and ESG, and that's led to targeting of him in particular by a lot of the Republican states and the attorney generals. And then you've seen over the last couple of weeks, BlackRock and State Street and Vanguard and J.P. Morgan have announced that they're withdrawing from some of these net zero alliances, which have been set up, and they basically are meant to defund the oil and gas industry. But, you know, I think that's, you know, withdrawing from those net zero clubs is clearly because they're concerned about antitrust litigation. And rightly so, because it's very easy to sue them based on, you know, the tenants and the membership in that group. So that's why they're retreating. I think they will still vote the same way and act the same way. So I think we need to keep that in mind. And I think when Larry Fink says, I'm not going to use the word ESG because it's become politicized, you know, he's not changing the behavior of the firm. I think they're just waiting for air cover from the regulators. When the regulators, the SEC, the Fed, the FDIC, the Department of Labor, when they finalize all the proposed rules that they're working on right now related to ESG and climate, then everyone will have to follow it, whether you're a believer or not. So I think a lot of these true believers, though, are backing away from it because, again, they don't want to be the target. But as you mentioned, some of the backlash that BlackRock has experienced, it really hasn't been that painful. In 2022, a lot of the Republican states pulled money from them, if you remember, and it was about $4 billion of assets. But in that same year, which was a down year for the market, the firm had more than $300 billion of net inflows, completely dwarfing whatever was taken out by red states. So, you know, it's going to take a lot, given the, you know, the business model and the size of BlackRock, to do damage to them. And I think it's somewhat misplaced, because even if you got BlackRock to really back off from it and say, we're never going to do this again, it's not going to change the fact that regulations are coming to force everybody. No one's following Larry Fink's lead on sustainability because they think it's going to lead to better returns. Everyone is kind of doing it, whether they believe or not, because they're afraid. And if they speak out, they become the next target.
Right. Right. So
that's a terrible way to make decisions on how we invest, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah. Give us a kind of a snapshot on how ESG works, and as far as the financial markets and how it affects the, or how they are affecting who the winners and losers are.
Sure. So just get the definition. So ESG is environmental, social, governance. These are non-financial factors. And the argument is that they should be used to drive corporate policy and investment portfolio decisions, as opposed to objective financial metrics.
Which is, you know, lunacy on the face of it.
I'm sorry?
And which is just lunacy on the face of it.
Right, right. I mean, again, this is why they've not allowed anyone to criticize it, because it would be obvious truths that you would point out immediately. So these are morally subjective, non-financial factors, And the argument that they're making is, if you focus on these things, the people working on Wall Street, eventually it will create financial value for you over the long term. They never actually define how long that long term is, and you never actually get to that horizon. But that's kind of the premise of it, which is ridiculous on its face. And, you know, it's predicated on the theory of stakeholder capitalism, which has been mainly championed by the World Economic Forum over the last 50 years, which says that, you know, you need to run companies not for the good of their owners and their capital providers and their employees. You need to run it for the good of society, for people and planet, as they say, which, again, that's a ludicrous concept. I mean, most CEOs don't really have that skill set to solve the world's problems. And then, obviously, it's really that's the domain of governments in terms of fixing those bigger issues. And it's not capitalism. I mean, stakeholder capitalism may be the end stage of capitalism if we don't turn this thing around, but it's basically government-directed capitalism, which the last time I checked is basically fascism. And you can actually trace back a lot of the language and the structure and the argument here to the 1930s in Germany and Italy.
Yeah, one of the lines in your book under returns and ESG performance art, which I thought was a great title for the chapter. You say the long-term investment horizon is never actually defined. Like the actual horizon is something that is always just over the next hill and forever out of reach. And that's so true.
Yeah, I mean, and there's been no shortage of research pumped out by business schools to try and prove that premise, looking at historical data, mm-hmm. that an ESG approach will lead to, that it's basically a positive catalyst for performance. And they've had studies going back to 1970, and then they've rolled them forward. And, you know, I think most of the research you can, you know, basically throw in the same category as Bigfoot sightings, because they all kind of have the same conclusion. It's like, well, we see something, we're not quite sure what it is. You know, if only we had better visibility and data.
Yeah.
So we have to keep on looking, because yeah. we know the truth is out there.
And we have to believe.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You got to believe, like in the X-Files. So all of them, you know, kind of fall in that category, less than persuasive. The other problem with them, I mean, there are two inherent problems trying to prove it. One, I worked in the markets in the 80s, the 90s, and the 2000s. No one talked about ESG during those decades. No one talked about moral investing, really. So they're trying to prove basically that, you know, everybody in the market was doing this, but they didn't really know what they were doing. But ESG was still having an impact on positive performance that no one saw, even though the financial markets are efficient, right? So that's kind of a crazy argument that they're making.
Well, but, and the idea that when you hear moral investing, I mean, it's almost like they were investing in what? Child trafficking or something. I mean, that's not the kind of moral investing I think most people, you know, they wouldn't want to support things that were horrible. But I think a lot of this stuff is unproven and subjective and yeah, Bigfooty. I wish I had a Bigfoot song, darn it. I have to take a really quick break here. And
sure.
We'll be right back with our guest, Paul Theiss. His book is fascinating, and you should definitely get yourself a copy, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. Someone finally wrote a book about it. Yay. We'll be right back. We'll talk to him a little bit more. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
A great big the gold in California is in a bank in the middle of Beverly Hills. It's somebody else's name. So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you played before. California's a brand new game.
And I'm sure we're the ones who brought you these policies of ESG.
Right out of California.
Just tell me, did they start here?
The birthplace of lunacy.
I know. Guest is Paul Tice's book is The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. It's a book filled with facts. What a clever idea. A book filled with facts. So finish your thought, Paul, before you're so rudely interrupted by free enterprise.
So the other ridiculous premise of the argument that ESG leads to better returns is that even if the historical record proved it, and you could point to some past performance that was positive, going forward, they're completely changing what the focus has to be with regard to ESG. It has to be all focused on climate change and getting to net zero, decarbonizing, and none of that we've experienced historically. So that's uncharted territory, and you know, I think we know how that ends, and that's one reason for the subtitle of the book, in terms of, you know, the ominous forecast. Unless we start, you know, changing this thing, you know, shifting away from fossil fuels based on a politically driven transition. It's not based on science. It's not based on market demand. We can't complete it as dialed because we don't have the technology to do it.
No,
and we've gotten glimpses of the unintended or, you know, perhaps intended consequences of going down this road in Europe and parts of this country already because, you know, our electric grids are getting more unstable. You know, if we have bad weather in the winter and they go down, people die like we saw in Texas. People will have lower living standards. Poverty will increase. We'll have less economic growth because fossil fuels has been the driver of capitalism for the last 200 years. That's the reason why ESG and all the activists around it are so focused on getting to net zero. It's a way to control and basically shut down oil, gas, and coal. And you can see what they're doing to coal in this country already. So that scenario, that macroeconomic scenario of net zero is negative, and it can't be positive for the financial markets, right? So that is basically the point around cratering the financial system. And no one in the market really talks about that fact, which is striking to me, because clearly the outlook will be negative for the financial markets. It can't be positive right now because, you know, we're electrifying the entire economy here as well as in Europe, and we're becoming more dependent on intermittent solar and wind. And the only way to plug the difference there is if you have demand management, which is a polite way of saying you could have power outages, you know,
yeah,
targeted at specific customers.
Yeah, you can use it between 1 and 4, but after 4 and 7, you got to, you know, light a fire. No, and you know, a good example is what we're seeing in the EV industry right now. I mean, look at a lot of our major manufacturers are kind of backing away after losing billions of dollars in this electric vehicle market because we're not ready for it. We're not set up for it. Our infrastructure can't handle it.
Well, they told people in California not to charge their electric vehicles because the grid couldn't take it.
Yeah, and what are we, 3% of the vehicles on the road right now, and they want to go, 100% by 2035 or some stupid thing? It can't happen. I mean, a child can see that is a bad idea.
Not Greta Thunberg.
Well, we're going to talk about the youth movement, but they're definitely picking winners and losers, and their big target is oil and gas right now, and I mean that's having a big impact on everything.
Yeah, I mean, that's the other piece of the negative scenario is that if you, you know, it's just the law of economics. If you defund oil and gas, they're not going to have the capital they need to grow. You will constrain supply in this country and in the developed world, and that's going to lead to higher energy prices. And everyone knows that higher energy prices feed into everything, mm-hmm. particularly food prices. So it's going to make the inflation of the last 2 years basically look like child's play.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and when you talk about the oil and gas industries being impacted, one of the big things that I don't think a lot of people realize is the fact that these companies need to go to banks and financial institutions for capital. And they're a dirty word right now. They're not getting the money. So when they say, oh, we have all these oil leases that are available, they're just not taking advantage of them. Well, they would if they could, but aren't they being really impacted and restricted by a lot of these regulatory agencies and financial institutions because they don't want to be involved in that type of industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think when it comes to the energy industry, it's kind of a pincer approach by Democrats. And you know, we should be upfront that ESG is progressive politics masquerading as finance.
Right.
And so when the other side tries to shut you down by saying you're just being political if you criticize me, it's like, no, we need to embrace that this is a political issue and not be afraid to speak out. So it is all Democrats that uniformly line up with the ESG agenda, similar for climate change. So I think we should be upfront about that. So, you know, Democrats, you know, particularly now when they control the White House, you know, they use an all-of-the-above approach. And during the Obama years, he also used that. But I think that was a cynical phrasing on their part because when he said all-of-the-above, it kind of implied that he was okay with fossil fuels, being alongside you know, renewable sources and letting the market decide. Now, when Democrats say all of the above, to my mind, that means they're going to use every means that they have, regulatory and legal, to mm-hmm. shut down oil and gas. And clearly their behavior shows that. So you've got now ESG in the finance markets used to defund it, but then you also have a lot of the other regulatory agencies passing new rules to kind of constrain them, claw back land from them, so there's less drilling activity. So, you know, just a short list that we've had. We have a methane tax now in this country, which started at the beginning of this year. They have paused LNG export approvals by the DOE. And, you know, I think after this election, if we have to deal with another Democratic term, God forbid, yeah. then and that's going to lead to a moratorium. And then you can see all of the regulations that are being passed, federal and state level, with regard to not producing internal combustion engine vehicles anymore. You know, we have that problem here on the East Coast. And then the regulatory agencies are not allowing you to have gas infrastructure in your house, so they're going after furnaces, they're going after stoves, they're going after generators. So this is all kind of a choreographed, coordinated effort to box in the industry. But on the financing side, to your original point, this is already happening, and people are not focusing on it. The number of European banks that will no longer lend to oil and gas continues to grow. It's roughly 10 right now. And eventually, the U.S. banks will fall in line.
You think they will fall in line? Do you think they really believe that this is a doable program?
The problem is, and this, I think, is a dynamic to recognize around Wall Street, when you work in a regulated industry, it's very tough to push back on the government. And I think with Wall Street, the history since the global financial crisis has made the industry completely subservient to the government. And you see what happened during the last 10 to 12 years. Right after the crisis, they were blamed for everything, even though, you know, clearly there was a government policy issue around subprime mortgages that kind of infected the entire system. But the industry was sued. You know, they paid out billions. They have millions of more hours of compliance that they have to deal with now. And then the Fed came in and left interest rates at zero, which kind of made the everyone in the market kind of dependent on government for their market cues, right? And that went on for a prolonged period. And I would argue it still, you know, persists to this day, even though we've had, you know, some return in terms of normal interest rates. But everyone is expecting the Fed to always just bail out the market by dropping interest rates again. And we have that you know, that same dynamic right now. So I think the industry, it's very tough to speak out if you're regulated. And so I wouldn't put it past a number of these banks to maybe capitulate. I mean, if you look at a Wells Fargo, which has had clear governance issues over the years, they have an energy lending business. Would they throw that over the side, you know, to pick up brownie points for the regulator or the public? You can't rule it out. And I'll give you an example of one that I was surprised, actually, that capitulated. But a couple of weeks ago, Barclays, which is the UK bank, came out with a climate change statement, which basically just lays out the roadmap that they're not going to be lending to oil and gas anymore. You can read between the lines. And so they succumbed to the pressure from activists over in Europe. But Barclays bought Lehman Brothers. They bought the U.S. broker-dealer back in 08 for a song, I would add. And with that, they inherited the energy banking franchise from Lehman Brothers. So they were a major, probably the major European bank that was still involved with oil and gas in the U.S. And they have capitulated. So I wouldn't rule it out for anybody. And even at J.P. Morgan, you would say that they are the leading oil and gas lending company, and they would never go. But their asset management side internally, they withdrew from that net zero. You know, they have their sustainability policies there. It's going to be tough for them to reconcile that internally. So it's tough to handicap whether a CEO just doesn't want to have to deal with this grief in the remaining years that they have running a company. You know, that's a tough personal calculation. So, and I think generally speaking, a lot of CEOs don't have the courage of their conviction. Even in the energy sector, where you know that they're coming after you, a lot of the energy CEOs have not been speaking out, I think, you know, strongly enough to defend themselves and the industry.
Mm-hmm. Do you think with a new administration, if we went with a conservative administration, they can turn this around, or are these regulating agencies just too strong now to turn the ship?
No, I there's always hope. So the book was not meant to basically be a downer for everybody. So I think we just need to start focusing on, between now and 2030, things I think will become more aggressive on the other side, because 2030 is a real date for climate change and sustainable development and ESG. You know, by 2030, they want to have a sustainable global financial system and all that entails. So I think after 2024, which is an important election year in this country, obviously, but actually worldwide, there are a lot of important elections here. Depending on how those ballots go, you may have the declaration of a global climate emergency as early as 2025. And the body language has clearly been there from the UN and from the International Energy Agency. So that may give them more emergency powers like we saw during COVID, and maybe that was the template to use, you know, under the threat of climate.
Right.
So we'll have to see, but, you know, I don't think all is lost. I would approach the book from a Dickensian approach. This is the ghost of Christmas yet to come unless we change our ways. Right. That's the way I would look at it. So there's still time. Mm-hmm. But we need to have smart tactics right now, and, you know, starting with the fact that we shouldn't be afraid to speak obvious truths about what's going on in the financial markets with ESG, and also climate change. You know, I think, because if you can finally address the climate theory and all these regulations that have now come into place through non-democratic means, that will, you know, take out everything from ESG. Because away from climate change and net zero, ESG is basically just a bunch of progressive wants over the years that they've somehow rebranded as sustainable goals for business and investing. Everything else will blow away in the wind, I think, if we succeed on the climate front. So, we haven't had a referendum in this country. on climate change, where it's serious, and whether we want to undertake what's involved. It's just been implemented behind the scenes through regulatory agencies and through the judicial system. Mm-hmm. So that's where we need to focus the attack going forward, and I think it's going to require government resources led by the red states, honestly.
Right, right. No, you're absolutely right. It's the environmental approach, I think, is what we need to concentrate on, and it will, I think, make the rest of it kind of fall away once we take a position and get in the right direction on this whole global warming or climate change or whatever they're calling it now.
Well, I mean, we have scientists that are being demonized for bringing up science. Now we have economists and people in the financial sector being demonized for bringing up facts.
Oh, yeah.
I'd like to hear what kind of, when we come back, we have to take a quick break, but when we come back, I would love to hear what the response has been to your book from maybe outside the smart people you deal with, just from the rank and file out there. What sort of heretic are you? We're going to have to change our show called The House of Heretics, I guess. We love interviewing heretics. We'll be right back. You are listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Compliance. We just need your compliance. You will feel no pain anymore. No more defiance. We just need your compliance. Just give us your compliance. We won't let you feel lost anymore. No more self-reliance.
I remember when I lost my
back with our guest Paul Tice. Okay, so Paul, who's on your camped on your trail here, probably trying to get you fired from your job?
Well, I mean, the only way I could write this book was because I retired from my last job 2 years ago. So cancel culture is real, and I kind of experienced that over the tail end of my career, because as I wrote more publicly in the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, I was basically kind of running on a fairway in terms of being able to express my views. I think there's a lot of that going on, which is one reason why you haven't heard from a lot of people criticizing it. There was one article I was writing just talking about that dynamic on Wall Street, the fact that, analysts can't speak up against it. And I couldn't get anyone, obviously, to go on record to give me a quote, but it was even tough to get people that I know give me an anonymous quote, because they thought, they would backtrack that they knew me. So, it's a very totalitarian, yeah, pressurized system, and people, are not comfortable speaking out. I was lucky that I was at the tail end of my career. I was kind of getting tired of not being able to speak up. So the first thing I did was write the book after I left. And I think most of the, because this dynamic is still out there, most of the feedback I will get will be through private text messages, which I've already gotten, that people agree with me. So it's still going to be tough to get public voices. But I think by writing the book, I think there's strength in numbers. So hopefully this makes more people comfortable to speak out and say, yeah, this is ridiculous. And then over time, you know, maybe we can use that so that politicians, you know, will also get a stronger backbone and kind of lead the charge here. What I did in the book, you know, again, because I think climate change is the main focus here around ESG, the second chapter kind of goes through the entire argument around the so-called science and the problems with the data and all the fatal flaws that you have in the argument. And I approached it from a layman perspective, just so people are comfortable that everyone can have an opinion on this. You don't have to be a so-called scientist in order to have an opinion on it. And even the scientists who have a contra opinion on it are not allowed to speak up. So that tells you that this is really not science, it's more of a religion, to your point about heretics. But I think more people are speaking up, and hopefully, you know, that builds. And then I would argue that people should kind of take that confidence that they have speaking out about it, and again, pressure your lawmaker to do more, because, you know, honestly, we're 40 years into this, and we should have been pushing back on this a long time ago. But I think the Republicans really, at least at the federal level, haven't just had that strength of will. Hopefully at the state level, where you're actually challenging state economies for oil and gas producing red states, that's enough incentive for them to take the lead. And they already have started that. You've seen the beginnings of that. We just need to continue.
Yeah. One of the chapters in your book, chapter 9, is called The Children's Hour.
it's Bill's favorite chapter, by the way.
I got a kick out of it because it's so true. How the movement is using the youth as a weapon to advance their socialist moves. Talk to us a little bit about that. From Greta Thunberg to George Floyd, I mean the whole youth movement is, I don't know, it's particularly irritating to me how we're told that we need to take our cues from children because they know more about this than we do, and it really kind of frustrates me a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think it immediately shows you how intertwined this is all, because, you know, they've been using this hiding behind young people to push the climate agenda, and they're using the exact same tactics now when it comes to ESG. And it's basically a means to shut down the discussion.
Right.
Because you can't reason with children, as we all know, parents among us. So, and you can see that they put them out there, and, you know, they just spout off, you know, like Mao's Red Guards, you know, about climate change. And, you know, if you let them actually keep on talking, you can see how uneducated they are, sadly. I mean, the problem with, you know, skipping school on Fridays to talk about climate change is, you know, you're missing your education, you know, which I think is the issue with Greta Thunberg. But it's the same dynamic with ESG. They use the argument that, well, you better focus on this if you're working in asset management, because millennials will eventually have all the wealth in the market, and they care more about this than you do. And I think that's a valid point, or something we should be aware of, because of the indoctrination that has taken place in this country for the last 40 years. So if you're a millennial, you were born in 1980, all you've been exposed to, you know, during your education, K-12 or the universities, has been climate change ideology. And by the time you left college, you've got that ingrained in your mind, along with gravity, as a scientific given, right? And I see that teaching at the graduate school level in terms of some of the adults that I teach. So that's unfortunate. It's going to take a while to break that down. But these people are now moving into the business world, working on Wall Street, and so it's perfectly logical for them, in their corrupted minds, that, oh, yeah, businesses should be focusing on climate change and all these other social and environmental issues. That's perfectly normal, right? And it's just a matter of one or two generation turns before, you know, there aren't enough adults in the room and the decision makers are of this mind. So
yep.
We need to be focused on this right now. The argument that millennials, you know, they currently control a de minimis amount of financial assets in the system, but when all the rest of the baby boomers, including myself, are no longer here, all of that accumulated wealth will be passed down to millennials. So that's where they will have control of all the assets in the market. So another point that we need to like get on this right away while we're still kicking, so that we don't have that problem down the road. But I've seen that at the back end of my career, working with younger analysts, that you know they just have a different mindset, and that's unfortunate, because ESG is not an analysis.
No
matter how you slice it, it's not investment analysis. It's basically, you know, using a morally subjective prism to allocate capital. And all of those ESG factors are not determined by people in the market. It's determined by activists outside of the market. So it's removing the agency of everyone working, either for a business or for an investment manager.
Right. And I don't think it is fairly representing the actual investors who expect a return on their dollar, and this is what they're getting, is all this ESG stuff, and you know, children, you know, dictating, you know, where we should be investing our money in the long term, you know, that over the horizon thing that we just never seem to be able to find. It's very frustrating.
I think it would be good for a lot of people on the ESG side to read Lord of the Flies.
I'll bet you if you presented that to 10 millennials, they probably wouldn't know what you're talking about.
They should read Atlas Shrugged while they're at it, too. That also did not turn out well.
Yeah, actually, and I kind of touched on that as a theme. It's interesting because energy is a big theme within Atlas Shrugged.
Yep.
But it's energy of the mind there, and progressives, I think, are taking it literally. And so all the horrific scenes in that novel about society shutting down, you know, when you're not drilling for oil or the trains don't run, I mean, that's their dystopian vision with ESG, right? You're going to deprive the economy of fossil fuels. It's altruism, you know, pretty much what Ayn Rand warned us about, you know. Corporate altruism is basically ESG in a nutshell.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we're kind of living through that novel right now, and the other side just is not self-aware enough to realize that.
Well, if you inflict enough pain, they'll come around, and that's never a good philosophy at all.
Yeah.
No, I don't disagree, and hopefully it doesn't come to that. But I think back to you. What can we do? Obviously, if we get a Republican in the White House, which looks like it'll be Trump, that's going to be a key win, because if we can keep the U.S. as a ESG-free country and financial market, I think it will collapse the whole global system, because it's a prisoner's dilemma. Everyone
sure.
has to like buy into it mm-hmm. and suspend disbelief. Otherwise, the whole system doesn't work.
Right.
Because obviously it's going to subjugate your particular economy. So everyone has to do that. So, you know, if the Republicans retake the White House, I think that's a good first step. But we need to do more than we did during the first Trump term, because we have to push back and go after, again, not just the financial regulations that are now coming on the ESG and climate front, but all the climate regulations that we're dealing with, a number of which were passed, you know, extra legally. So, you know, the Paris Agreement was never approved by the Senate. You know, it's
no,
illegal,
we're not bound
frankly,
by that.
In this country.
Right.
Right? The Sustainable Development Goals for the UN. Again, a treaty never approved by the Senate. So they need to be submitted to the Senate. They won't pass because it requires a supermajority, and that should take the legs out from a lot of this movement. And then if we have to go after the endangerment finding, which was the EPA under the Obama administration, which basically decided that carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases were regulated pollutants. That decision should be with the Congress. That was the case for the first 40 years of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. And so it needs to be kicked back to Congress. And clearly that was a political decision that was rushed within 9 months of Obama coming in. So, you know, there are a lot of things that we can go after. I think if Chevron, that decision which comes down in the next few months, is worded properly, it'll give us more ammunition to go after some of these executive actions, which, you know, I think have had, you know, this deference, you know, invisible shield around them unfairly, you know, up until now. So.
Do you think if we do are able to reverse some of this stuff in the United States and other countries see that, hey, they're, you know, they're leaving us behind or they're being more successful, do you think that's going to be enough to change the mindset in Europe? Because, I mean, they've got to change as well. And I think some of the things that are happening over there with coal and you know, wind and solar and all this, I think are starting to kind of crack the paradigm a little bit, that this wind and solar thing is the answer. But do you think with the United States making the change to go back to a more reasonable energy solution will be enough to change Europe?
Well, I think it will put them out there on their own. And so they will sink or swim based on their own policies.
Right.
I think it's important to note, too, around ESG, as with climate change, this is basically a two-tiered system where the industrialized world has to adhere to all of these restrictions. The developing world, including China and India, don't.
Yeah.
And that also applies to ESG.
Right.
Even though I would argue that companies in India and China and in the emerging markets are a lot more risky than public companies in the U.S. or Europe, but that's the opposite world that we're living in with ESG. But if the U.S. can you know, carve itself out and not comply, then Europe will sink or swim based on their goal to be the first net zero continent.
Right.
That is going to lead to deindustrialization. You've already seen that.
Well,
the European economy hasn't grown in a decade.
No.
Sure. And it's like how the Canadians come here for surgery all the time. So we're busy imploding our own medical system so we can be like the Canadians somehow. Yeah, go figure that out. Our guest this hour is, we're going to make him come back. We're going to hold him as our hostage at some future time. Paul Theis, you are super, super interesting, and we appreciate you coming on with us. Please go out and get his book, The Race to Zero, How ESG Investing Will Crater the Global Financial System. There is much more to discuss with him in the future. Thank you, Mr. Theis, for being on with us.
Yeah, thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thanks, guys, for having me. I appreciate it.
There ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.